Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm John Milford, chair of the club's Grown-Ups Forum and your host for today. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's our pleasure to introduce our distinguished panel. And I will introduce first Helen Carr, who will then introduce her fellow panelists. Helen Carr is one of my favorite people, and here's why. Helen is the Elder Abuse Special Assistant in the San Francisco District Attorney's Office. Helen Carr was formerly in the business of leasing space from department stores for hair salons. Through the salon owners and staff, she heard so many stories of elderly women being financially exploited that at age 65, Carr decided to go to law school to work on combating the problem. She's now an advocate for seniors in the DA's office. And I think you must be getting younger every year because of your active volunteering. So I present to you our moderator, Helen Carr. Helen?
Thank you, John. Thank you very much. And I have to do a couple of corrections. I didn't become an attorney until I was 64, so I started law school before that. And I'm retired from the DA's office and from the state bar. So good evening. It's my pleasure to be here. And thank you for attending this program. And my thanks to the Commonwealth Club for providing a forum to raise awareness of elder financial abuse. And a special thanks to John Milford, who remembered that the month of May in California is Elder Independent Adult Abuse Awareness Month. And I want to thank our panelists, Assistant DA Conrad Del Rosario and Dr. Elizabeth Landsberg. Assistant DA Del Rosario, who is the managing attorney for the economic crimes in the San Francisco District Attorney's Office, has been a prosecutor for 21 years, and in the past 10 years has been prosecuting white-collar crimes. He oversees the prosecutions and the investigations, handling various types of fraud-related crime, including financial elder abuse, real estate and mortgage fraud, annuity and insurance fraud, identity theft, and high technology crimes. He is a certified instructor for the Peace Officer Standards and Training and trains law enforcement throughout the state on high technology investigations. He will provide insights tonight into the San Francisco cases of real estate and mortgage fraud. And then our geriatrician, Dr. Elizabeth Landsberg, was previously an assistant professor at UCSF and a consultant to the San Francisco Forensic Center, but she founded Elder Consult Geriatric Medicine, and that is a house call practice in the Bay Area, and is presently adjunct professor at Stanford, and she will discuss dementia, capacity, and elder abuse. So we'll leave time at the end for questions, but my thoughts and opinions about elder financial abuse are based on my own experience and observations. And I'm convinced that the greatest problem that seniors today are facing is elder financial abuse. No elder, no matter how rich or poor, is immune from this devastating crime. So tonight I'm going to focus on financial abuse and tell you that it is, and remind you that it's under-recognized and under-reported. And I'm going to talk about mandated reporting. But first, I want to tell you about a criminal case here in San Francisco. Mr. Williams was an 80-year-old who lived with his 80-year-old wife, and the nearest relatives lived in another country and in the eastern United States. When the wife died, the nephew visited the uncle for the funeral and noticed there was a lot of money around the house and urged him to deposit it in the bank. So he went to his bank branch, where he had a savings account, and he deposited $90,000 that day. So then nephew returned home to his country, and in a few days, the bank teller from that bank knocked on his door and said that she could help him with his finances. And he said, you know, he didn't want her to help him. and he didn't know what to do. And he came from a country where they really didn't rely on the police or banks, but he did like the medical profession. So he ran out on the street. Someone called 911. He ended up in a San Francisco emergency department, and he told the physician that he really wasn't in any pain, but this young woman was stealing from him. So here he was, this old man with an accent. So the doctor assumed he was hallucinating and ordered psychotropic drugs and sent him home. So he tried that same scene again, and it didn't work. So he tried talking to different people, and I'm not sure where, but no one believed him. So what happened? He didn't know what to do. So within 3 years after his wife died, he had $12,000 in the bank. She had proceeded to move $250,000 out of his savings account into her own bank accounts. She had forged his signature. And then she put him in an assisted living, and she moved into his San Francisco house. So 2 to 3 weeks before he passed away, someone finally believed him. It was an ombudsman that had visited the facility, and she made a police report. And so it ended up being a prosecution case in here in San Francisco. But why am I telling you about this? Well, it's to raise awareness, especially this heinous crime of financial elder abuse. Because many people think that it's just physical abuse, that it only happens in nursing homes. But only 4% of us at any one time reside in a long-term care facility. So that means 95% or more living in their own home or the home of others. And most form of any abuse, therefore, occurs in the home. And 50% of any abuse involves some kind of a financial issue. And elder abuse is plainly described as the painful or harmful mistreatment of elders. And it is a crime. But financial abuse is stealing, embezzling, criminal fraud, misuse of power of attorney, identity theft or forgery. But it's also broadly defined as the illegal or improper use of funds, property, or assets of anyone 65 or older. And it is a crime. It's been called the crime of the 21st century. And in my opinion, it's a very silent crime. According to a recent study, perpetrators of elder financial abuse are typically not strangers. They are people who have gained the trust of an elder individual, including business and service professionals and family members. According to the National Association of Adult Protective Services, 88% of financial abuse is perpetrated by family members, business professionals, service providers, or someone that elder knows. And over 40% of the perpetrators, though, are adult children. There's many consequences. According to the U.S. Department of Justice, financial abuse can leave an elder person in poverty and homeless. They can suffer tarnished credit scores and credit records. It can result in their loss of independence and their forced reliance on their family and the welfare system. They can become fearful, depressed, and even suicidal. And then the financial loss has health consequences as well and has been linked to hospitalization. And victims may be unable to afford their medications and their basic necessities because someone has taken all their money. And it can be deadly. And it is known that an elder who has been abused is 3.1 times more likely to die at an earlier death than expected. So according to a national study, elder abuse is under-recognized and under-reported. Most states have mandated reporter laws, but mandated reporters sometimes don't recognize this crime because if it's bruises or broken bones, then they know that elder abuse is involved. But if it's just financial, they don't know that. And victims might not realize that they can be under-medicated. And then, but I want to tell you what Mickey Rooney said. He was our beloved film star who passed away recently, and he was financially abused. And he said, it seemed to happen out of nowhere. At first, it was something small, something I thought I could control. Then it became sinister and completely out of control, unquote. So even if it's recognized, it's underreported, and they say that maybe 1 in 100 cases of elder financial abuse is ever reported. And sometimes mandated reporters fail to make a report, and they are mandated to report to APS. And it was recently brought to my attention that here in the Bay Area, a police officer failed to take a police report when contacted about elder abuse. The police officer who took the elder financial abuse phone call advised the reporting party to obtain a civil attorney and to be thankful that the older woman was being finally, you know, taken care of. So where does an elder person turn if the police don't even recognize that elder abuse is a crime? So, and then, of course, the victim might not even realize they're being financially abused. You know, you can steal someone's bank account between statements, and then if you're the perpetrator and you have access to their mail, you're certainly not going to let them see their financial statements, so they might not know it. And but there's other reasons that people, even if they know it, they won't report. They don't want the government to interfere with their personal lives. They worry that the perpetrators may retaliate. They fear that if they report abuse by a caregiver or family member, there's nobody to care for them. And Mickey Rooney stated his fears. He said, quote, "For years I suffered silently. I couldn't muster the courage to seek out the help I knew I needed. And even when I tried to speak up, I was told to be quiet. It seemed no one believed me," unquote. So we must recognize it. And once we suspect it's happening, we must report it. California law encourages everyone to report known or suspected elder abuse of any form. Unless you're a mandated reporter, you can remain anonymous. So if you know, if you can call the Adult Protective Services here in San Francisco. It's 415-557-5230. Or you can call the Elder Care Locator at 800-677-1116. Older adults are reminded, do not sign any document unless someone you trust reviews it. Do not be left out of decisions about your finances. And in order to confront this problem, we must continue to raise awareness. And every year, the month of May in California is Elder and Dependent Adult Abuse Awareness Month. And I am pleased that many California nonprofits and governmental agencies, including our San Francisco District Attorney, have conferences and rallies during May. And again, my thanks to the Commonwealth Club for including elder abuse awareness in its May program. But I want to end my part by wishing everyone to remember that it's not only a silent crime, it's really an evil crime. And I'm going to quote Reverend Martin Luther King on this, even though he was referring to civil rights. Quote, "To ignore evil is to be an accomplice to it," unquote. So I want you to know there's handouts on the back table from the DA's office and from the state bar. And let us welcome Assistant District Attorney Conrad Del Rosario.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Conrad Del Rosario, and I'm actually one of the managing attorneys in the White Collar Crimes Division. White Collar Crimes Division is actually two subdivisions, subunits, economic crimes and special operations. Many of the cases that I've overseen, both the prosecution and the investigations, relate to not just elder financial abuse, but other types of crimes. And this is why it's relevant. Under the California law, elder financial abuse is actually a special class of victims that are given special attention and special consideration under the law. So basically, as what Helen was saying, is if you've got a theft or an embezzlement or a forgery or a fraud, and the target is an elderly or a dependent adult, the law gives them special punishment, special in the sense that it enhances it. So that opens the door to what is theft, fraud, embezzlement, identity theft. So you see all these different schemes that are perpetrated and targeting seniors, especially when there's vast amounts of money. There's one area that I want to touch upon because 15 minutes isn't enough to talk about the entire subject of financial elder abuse. But one particular area that I think has very strong relevance to the Bay Area, the San Francisco Bay Area, is this whole idea of real estate fraud. And this is something that I've been seeing a little bit more frequently. We were seeing investigations in this area. But let me give you the set of circumstances where this becomes more prevalent. Is you have somebody that buys property in San Francisco when property used to be reasonable, right? The prices used to be reasonable, maybe back in the 70s. They work their entire life paying the mortgage. So the house has either got paid off or there's a very small mortgage that remains on the property. Because a lot of people, you know, they come from the old school where they're going to say, I'm just going to save, I'm going to pay my mortgage, and eventually we're going to pay off the house. That's the American dream. So years down the road, you have a house that has a very small mortgage, and then all of a sudden you have this equity or this appreciation rise in the value of the property. So now you're looking at property with a very small mortgage worth hundreds of thousands, if not million. Okay? So now you've got the setting for the perfect storm. All you need now is for some predator or some fraudster, could even be a family member, to come in and see this person whose faculties may be compromised is sitting on a lot of money, equity. Okay? So this is kind of like the set of circumstances that we're beginning to see. And then you'll see these fraudsters come in and they'll befriend them or they'll be a trusted member of the family at that time. And all of a sudden you'll see these really anomalous transactions. And here's the worst of all the types of tragedies that we see is what is the one document that says that you own your house, your deed, right? You can go to the recorder's office, and unless the recorder sees something patently false about that document, if it looks like it's a correct transfer of property and there's a notary stamp on it, and trust me, with all the computerized equipment out there right now, it's not that difficult to, you can even do it with a copy machine. Unless that document looks faulty on its face, they will record it. You will not know. And there's no duty for them to call, hey, do you know that there's now a transfer of title that's been filed on the property that you own? That doesn't happen. So not until years down the road when something happens that you actually realize that there is a document on file in the recorder's office that your property has been transferred. All the money and all the equity, all the hard sweat that you put into that property is now in the hands of someone else. Or alternatively, someone has put their name on the property jointly with you so that upon the elder's passing, that person would be able to inherit the property. Okay, this is something that is, the reason why I raised that, one, because San Francisco's real estate market speaks to it, but secondly, because there's much more difficult, it's fairly difficult for someone who's even not an elder and maybe even sophisticated in real estate to check title on their property. Who checks title on your property? The only people I know that checks title are your title companies, and that's when you're about to sell your house or refinance your house. But short of that, you don't have that. We prosecuted a case last summer. It involved the defendant who was, I believe, in his 40s. There was two separate victims who were befriended by who he befriended. One victim was in his 80s, but he had clear dementia. And the other victim, by the time she testified at trial, was 96. And the first victim, the elderly man, he passed by the time we went to trial. However, we took a video recording of his testimony at one of the earlier stages of the proceeding. And he sounded completely coherent with regard to the financial transactions of his house, the transfer of the property. And you listen to the video, and it sounded like he consented to everything that the suspect had said, which was he willingly gave me the property to put both our names on the property. Until the one question was asked. And that question was, who do you live with? And he said, I live with the defendant, and I live with my mom. When was the last time you spoke to your mom? Spoke to her this morning before I left for court. His mom had passed away 10 years earlier. Okay, it takes that kind of information to present it in front of a jury to know it is not too difficult to know that the suspect should have known he was not in his clear faculties. the other lady, bless her heart, was one of the best victims I have ever, actually one of the best witnesses I've ever seen testify. And I think the first 5 minutes, I knew the jury really loved her because the prosecutor, I watched the prosecutor on this case, asked her, how did you get to San Francisco back in the 40s, which now lands you in San Francisco. She said, oh, you know, I took the bus and I had to go from New Orleans to Los Angeles and I went to San Francisco. But, you know, those days, and this is what she was recounting in front of the jury, those days were really hard because we weren't allowed to sit in the front of the bus. And the jury loved that. And the jury knew that this was someone that they can trust. And all of a sudden when she started bringing out the full story, which was I trusted what he was going to do. He gave me documents to sign and I signed them. The jury knew what was going on and they can read through that. But those are one of the few types of cases that surface for prosecution, that gets investigated thoroughly by law enforcement agencies, and they can actually have an investigator to weed through all the documents and figure out what the course of the scheme is. These are schemes that are perpetrated where they're involving hundreds of thousands of dollars. And I would venture to say most of the times, if not all the times, these would be the only remaining assets of the elderly. And that's why these kind of crimes really have a very tone set to them. This specific population doesn't have the ability. They didn't grow up with the internet. They didn't grow up with Google. So it's not like they go around searching what's going on with their property. I mean, they don't pull up their phone and start downloading the most recent apps. So it's very difficult for them to actually get in tune with finding out anything that goes on with their financial transactions, with their financial institutions. One of the other areas that I oversee is identity theft. And identity theft, it targets seniors as well. A lot of these fraudsters will know exactly which victims are not going to be able to check up on where their mail has been rerouted to or where their bank statements are going. I mean, how many people have access to their credit bureaus and check them on a regular basis online? So they know that's not going to happen, so they're free to open up credit card accounts and things of that nature. And sometimes it's extremely difficult to track this down once it's reported, but it's even more difficult to even detect it. So in my experiences at the DA's office, we take these cases very seriously. When we know that it's an elderly victim who is specifically being targeted, we give it vertical attention, which means we have one prosecutor that assists in the investigation, takes it all the way to trial if necessary. That way the victim doesn't get shuffled around. That way the victim is able to give this is able to build a rapport with the same prosecutor throughout the entire case. And that way the victims don't feel like they're being re-victimized because they don't have that contact in law enforcement. It becomes a very scary experience, and you oftentimes will need that support because it is a very testing process to go through trial. But other areas involving financial elder abuse, I could foresee in the next, I've seen some cases that involved like annuity scams where you have insurance agents who are going around and selling annuities, which are basically policies or which are basically some type of an investment where they're going to get paid, but they make commissions and they keep selling these annuities even though the products haven't been fully vetted out. You know, one of the things I've always asked many of the victims when they're being when the cases are being investigated is, why did you trust him? And usually it's because he's the only person I could talk to. So that trusting value is what really these predators and fraudsters will look for. As long as they can work their way into the lives of the victim, they know they can get the victim to basically do anything. And oftentimes it's going to be, if they have a lot of money, those transactions are going to yield them rewards if they can get away with the crime. So as Helen was saying, if there is any instance when you find somebody and you think there's something fishy about the way the transaction occurs, or they start feeling, or they start moving away from you and they start gravitating towards somebody else, it's kind of like the first red flag that you'll see. And from there, you really have to keep monitoring it to make sure that there isn't I always worry about my mom. Like, do you still own the property? I need to go check your title report. But it's something that we all should be aware of. And these are crimes that I think in San Francisco are going to be more prevalent because of the value of real estate. Okay? So with that, I think I'll turn it over. Thank you.
Well, thank you. This is an honor to speak here this evening, and I would say that my take on it is complimentary. I really appreciate having you all in law enforcement to protect our vulnerable elders. And what I'm going to talk about a bit is what sorts of things can make them more vulnerable. I just gave this talk at the Legal Assistance for Seniors Elder Abuse Conference yesterday, but I got 90 minutes. So this is going to be a very distilled version of it. So why is there such a connection between elders and financial abuse? As bank robber Willie Sutton said, that's where the money is. Even for elders who don't have much, some Grinch abusers will take their last can of WHO hash. A recent New York Times ethicist column caught my eye. A son had written in to the ethicist team to ask if he should rescue his irresponsible parents who had fallen behind in their mortgage. Apparently, the parents had mismanaged their finances to such a point of bankruptcy a few years prior. The son was worried that he'd just be supporting their uncontrolled spending and their inability to face reality. It's not the problem that caught my eye. I work with families facing these kinds of issues every day as I do geriatric house calls around the San Francisco Bay Area for Elder Consult Geriatric Medicine. What caught my eye was the responses of the three ethicist experts. One gave tips about a tough love discussion with the parents. Another one said that both lending and withholding money would be considered ethical options. And the third said, if there's no cognitive impairment, the course was to get a financial professional involved. Here's what the experts left completely unaddressed. Cognitive testing. Rigorous, medical, evidence-based analysis of what's going on with his parents. Another New York Times article discussed the fact that, financial errors are a leading indicator of dementia in elder adults. And Dr. Daniel Marston, a leading researcher, demonstrated that elders with mild cognitive impairment made four times the errors of those elders who did not have cognitive impairment. That's not even having dementia. So this vignette illustrates the core of the problem I'd like to discuss this evening. Most people, even loving families, dedicated social workers, attorneys, judges, and even many doctors don't know how to spot the early signs of dementia or even why it's important to do so. They do not know when to get help. They do not know how to get help. Consider this in the context of three alarming sets of figures. One, the number of Americans over the age of 65 stands at 40 million. This population is growing at 15% a year, while the general population is growing at less than 10%. Approximately 10% of those over the age of 65 suffer from dementia, and by the age of 85, that number rises to 40 to 50%. Two, the rates of elder abuse, especially financial elder abuse, are also growing. The National Elder Mistreatment Study indicates that 10 to 20% of elders are abused. The numbers are even more shocking for those who suffer dementia. Approximately half of dementia patients are abused. And at the very minimum, at least 1 million seniors lose $2.6 billion each year, according to a study by MetLife. And as Helen said, my numbers were for every case reported, there's 40 that go unreported, but I'd easily believe 100. Three, an often cited study from the Journal of Gerontology Nursing in 2004 found that 80% of dementia patients in nursing homes were taking one psychotropic medication. 66% were taking two, 36% were taking three, and 11% were taking four or more psychotropic medications. So here's the situation. More and more elders, more and more dementia. More and more elders robbed of their life savings. Widespread ignorance of what dementia is and how it can be treated. More and more psychotropic medications used, more and more elders drugged into a stupor for their last years. This is not just a medical issue. This is not just a law enforcement or social service issue. I see this as the next civil rights struggle of the 21st century. Will we allow our elders to be robbed of their consciousness? Will we allow them to be over-sedated when there are alternatives that would allow them to enjoy life to their fullest capacity? Will we allow elders who are cognitively compromised to be ripped off and abused? Will we allow con artists and unscrupulous relatives, and professionals to strip our elders of billions and billions of dollars in assets? We are only beginning to understand these problems, and we certainly have not fashioned effective policies or laws to deal with them. We are far, far from allocating enough resources to make solutions a realistic hope. And in that vein, I understand Congress has finally allocated some funds for adult protective services. Until now, they had not. Consider that 30 years ago, federal law, OBRA 87, prohibited chemical restraint or oversedation of elders in nursing homes. Yet, almost every day, I encounter elders who have been drugged to the point of losing the person within. And frequently, I see that over-medicated patients have not only lost control of their consciousness, they've lost control of the assets they worked a lifetime to accumulate. Those assets are not being used to make the elder's life more comfortable. They're being used for the benefit of someone else. Of course, I don't have all the answers, but I do have some ideas about the issues we should be discussing. I'd like to take them one at a time. But before we get to those issues, let me run through a very quick tutorial about what dementia is, because I think it is widely misunderstood. Basically, dementia is a decline in the ability to think. Dementia is not just Alzheimer's disease. Many things can cause dementia, including small strokes, alcoholism, Parkinson's disease, and sometimes deficiencies of vitamin B12, folate, or thyroid problems. Dementia may cause memory loss, but not necessarily. I've had elders with fairly advanced dementia who can still play bridge, can play a cabaret of repertoire on the piano flawlessly, but still not take care of themselves by any means. Think of dementia as brain damage. It matters where the damage occurs. If the frontal cortex becomes damaged, the person will have difficulty maintaining appropriate social behavior, resisting urges, continuing with planning, judging risk, and making complex decisions. That's what we call executive function. Just because they can answer, what is the date today, who is the president, does not mean they're okay. It's entirely, As a society, we are terrible at recognizing the signs of early dementia. I would say that our current sophistication in diagnosing early dementia compares to where we were in cancer diagnosis in the 1950s. Many doctors, lawyers, and judges go with their gut about how the elder seemed in the interview. If they go as far as to test the elder, most medical professionals rely on the test popularly known as the mini-mental. But those questions do not test judgment or reasoning at all. No other medical disease, and yes, dementia is a disease, it's not just an alternative consciousness, gets such disregard. Perhaps it's because medical training usually does not include much discussion of early dementia. Perhaps it's because we doctors are trained to look at quantitative test results such as x-rays or blood tests. Perhaps because it's difficult to get insurers to pay for more complicated, accurate types of dementia exams, such as neuropsychologic testing for capacity level. Perhaps it's because these cognition exams are not the big money makers like biopsies or scans are. And perhaps it's because dementia is a complicated, confusing disease that is difficult to diagnose accurately and has no cure. As a society, we desperately need more accurate testing tools for dementia. Here are three of the most common. As I mentioned, the mini mental status exam, hereforth known as MMSE, is a 30-point test that gauges the orientation to time and place, the ability to spell a word backwards or to subtract serial sevens. It does not test for judgment or reasoning and tends to easily miss cases of impaired function in subjects who are even slightly advanced educational backgrounds. A score of 24 or more out of 30 is reported to indicate that someone does not have dementia. Also, a score of 24 or less is to indicate that an elder has dementia. I will come back to that in a minute. The MoCA, or the Montreal Cognitive Assessment, is a little bit more sensitive for mild cognitive impairment and requires making a trail between letters and numbers, which takes more abstract thinking. And the MiniCOG is a brief screen, which is a 3-item recall, and then drawing a clock face, which maybe in 30 years we won't be able to use because everyone has digital watches, but drawing a clock face and making it say 10 minutes after 11, which a common mistake if your thinking is a little bit off is that you put the hands on 10 and 11. But these are just screens. Some elders are clearly impaired. They're unaware of their surroundings and their needs. Here, I'm specifically discussing a dementia evaluation when capacity is in question. Some elders may have difficulty speaking due to a stroke or medication effects. A MMSE of 16 over 30 may label them incapacitated. However, if time is taken and medications are removed, they can communicate consistently that they are aware of their assets or what their wishes are for care. If there are signs of function problems and financial conflicts, there is a need for further testing. The gold standard right now is the full neuropsychological examination. This consists of a battery of detailed mental tests and is much more accurate than an evaluation done by the primary care doctor, the neurologist, the psychologist, or the psychiatrist who does not use this battery, and gives more detail about executive functions such as critical thinking or planning. Of note, the Iowa Gambler's Task is a specific assessment for risk assessment and may be the only abnormality in neuropsychologic testing that indicates the lack of capacity. So we look for a head CAT scan to see if there's abnormalities, strokes, tumors. We do the B12 folate and thyroid levels to see if there's a problem there. We evaluate for alcohol use because if an elder is a heavy drinker, we cannot accurately diagnose mental illness or dementia until the patient has been dry for 6 months. That's a hard bar to pass. A lot of elders may get diagnosed with dementia in the hospital. Yet in such settings, elders are very prone to delirium, which means an abrupt worsening of their thinking or function. This may be reversible, and the elder needs to be evaluated later after the medical crisis has passed. Yet if two doctors from this particular hospital write letters saying that the elder has dementia, that may be all it takes for the elder to lose autonomy forever. Why is this so important? Why is this a crisis that needs more public attention? Frankly, it's because criminals and con artists are much better at diagnosing early dementia than the rest of us are right now. Here are just a few of the scams out there. We've all heard about the bogus Nigerian bank scams. You've got $1 million in a Nigerian bank and you just have to send $1,000 for the taxes. Once the elder responds, the name is on a list and sold. And by the way, the reason it still says Nigerian bank is it cuts down the work of the criminal because someone who says, wait a minute, Nigerian bank, I've heard about that. I'm not going to send money. If they have impairment to the point that the Nigerian bank doesn't set off alarms, they're an easier target. So as I said, once the elder responds, the name is on a list and sold, then the phone and email predation and mail intensifies. I've seen elders lose thousands, tens of thousands this way to lotteries, to charities. There are many ways that they can be scammed. Then there are those who try to exert undue influence over elders. That is, they try to influence the elder to give them their money or assets, as was earlier described. They're not looking out for the elder's interests. They're looking out for number one. These abusers isolate and intimidate the elder, making them think that no one else will help. Don't call your son. He'll just put you in a nursing home. Elders lose their retirement accounts, their investments, even their homes this way. This is financial elder abuse. It is a crime. If you see it, call APS. Call the police, and you should get a good elder law attorney. Seniors who are financially abused are more likely to need medical care, thus adding to Medicare costs. Seniors who lose their savings need public support, adding to the local and state aid budgets. One Utah study found that 9% of financial abuse victims had to apply for Medicaid because they had nothing else left. And remember, as I said, approximately half of those with dementia will suffer abuse. I see this again and again in my elder consult cases. I treated a woman who suffered from diabetes and breast cancer. At 80 years old, she fled her son's home to live with her siblings. She did not trust her son. She understood her medical issues, but if you asked her to calculate 25% of $22.50, she could not do it. Her primary care doctor deemed her incapacitated. Her son took control, moved her to a dementia facility 40 miles away from her support network, and this woman was stuck alone in another county. If the abuser is the durable power of attorney and has a physician who agrees with the treatment of the elder, even in cases of older sedation, over-sedation and isolation, there's little that can be done to correct the abuse with our current laws and social services. Finally, I want to speak briefly about medication. This is a broad topic, but I want to make just a few points. First, an elder should not be on medications that can make their behavior look like dementia. Sedation from antipsychotics such as Seroquel, confusion from tranquilizers such as Ativan or Xanax or Ambien, agitation from Parkinson's meds such as Sinemet, or even over-the-counter meds such as Tylenol PM. Non-medical folks may not be in a position to know these subtleties, but it's critical that those who judge the capacity of an elder, doctors, attorneys, judges, and social workers, know how drugs might affect cognition. I have had a number of patients who seemed to have advanced dementia, but were actually suffering from the complications brought about by medications. Their problems resolved when the medications were tapered down and corrected. On my website, elderconsult.com/medications, there's a whole section about psychoactive medications, and it's written in English, not medical ease, so that is a quick reference. Remember that dementia is brain damage. Sometimes the brain damage results in very distressing and disturbing behaviors. A once shy man may start groping every woman who comes near him. An elderly woman may become combative and paranoid, attacking her caregivers. Others might try to climb out of windows or call out incessantly or refuse to eat or bathe or throw things or break furniture or harm themselves. The use of an antipsychotic might make all the difference in these cases. However, my goal is always to find the safest solution to meet the needs of the elder, relieving pain, engaging the elder in activities that they enjoy in the environment that they enjoy, and at times finding an effective medication. We need to talk more about these cases. In my experience, the anti-anxiety medications are not safer for dementia patients. Most doctors seem to think that anti-anxiety medications, especially the benzodiazepines such as Ativan and Xanax, should be the go-to drugs for the agitated elder with dementia. This assumption that tranquilizers are just fine has caused more misery than you can know. I have observed how the anxiety meds lead to confusion, more falls, and more agitation. All too often, the spiral of distressing behavior results in an antipsychotic prescription, often at a dose so high the person loses even more cognition. So let's take this lack of understanding of dementia and various medications and that treat the symptoms, add to it poor diagnosis tools, a lack of research, and an abundance of unscrupulous people, and you've got a recipe for disaster. Or take another common scenario. I treated an 80-year-old man with a stroke. He had had a bladder infection and became aggressive. He was admitted to the hospital and put on Seroquel, an antipsychotic. His son moved to gain durable power of attorney over the patient and moved him to an assisting living facility in another county away from his friends. When I visited him there, he would often be completely sedated by dinner time, unable to speak, move, or open his eyes. One of the patient's friends drove out to find him, advocate for him, and found him an attorney. Once the man was taken off of Seroquel, his cognition improved. He had a good cognitive assessment, was judged competent, and was returned to his home. Today, the treatment of dementia is just not a priority in our society, even though it destroys families, even though it is fantastically expensive and often dangerous. And I must say, it is completely arbitrary. The same scenario, given that if there's not the resource, if there's not an advocate for the elder, that person may stay sedated and shut away in a facility far away from all of those who care for him. Today, the diagnosis of dementia is often too little too late. We need to create an understanding that an elder cannot be said to have advanced dementia if they're taking sedating or agitating medications until these medications are removed. such as a gentleman who might have had, six shots of whiskey in an hour might not be able to walk. We do not call him a man who can't walk. You have to come back the next day when he hasn't had whiskey to see if he can walk. Similar for the psychoactive medications. You cannot say that someone just has advanced dementia or advanced Parkinson's and that's why they're acting that way if they're on 150 milligrams of Seroquel. We need all professions, medical, legal, and government, that work with elders to understand the details of early diagnosis, the effect and use of psychoactive medications, and the crucial role of neuropsychologic testing to accurately determine an elder's level of capacity and function. We need to create a system that routinely screens for early dementia and makes appropriate referrals for further evaluation and support where needed. And we need to require audits of their funds that are managed by a durable power of attorney or a trustee if there are concerns of misappropriation. We need to be alert to the possibility that psychoactive medications may cause symptoms that mimic dementia, not to act as doctors, but to see that those meds are red flags, similar to alcohol or drug use. We need to make sure that dementia is not a side issue. We need to recognize that it is a dire threat to the civil right of our elders, and we should make this a central conversation that we have as a society. I hope that I have done a bit to start this conversation today. Thank you.
We'd like to take a moment to remind our listening audience this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Combating Elder Financial Abuse. Our special thanks to our panelists, Dr. Landsberg, Mr. Del Rosario, Ellen Carr. Thank you so much. And I know there are questions in the audience, so would you be open to answering some questions? All right. If you'll raise your hand and speak into the mic, please, so that we can hear you.
How do you check into... Oh, I'm sorry. How do you check into your title report?
On your house.
On your house or condo or whatever.
The way I've... Generally, you're going to have to go to a title company to do the searches. You can actually do the searches at the recorder's office, but it's... From how I've seen the investigators do it, it's a fairly complex process. It's not like you can just pull up your property and then see all the title reports. It actually has to be done by a professional in order to gather all the documents. It's not as simple as I would hope or think it would be. The recorder's office is actually far more complex to be able to pull up any liens that might be on a property or any transfers of documents.
Hi, my name is Lynn. My husband is 72 and I'm 64. We get several phone calls a week attempting to depart us from our money, and they're all of a fraudulent nature. The scariest one was just yesterday when my alma mater supposedly called to ask for money and was insistent that I give a credit card number, and I said, no, I won't do that, and they said, okay, I'll send you something in the mail. It was clear they weren't going to do that, but my point is, where can we report these fraudulent phone calls?
I guess that's my question.
Vaughn, I just want to say that, I don't know if this is working.
Yes, sir.
First of all, get your phone on the do not call list. And then if you continue to get phone calls that you don't know the people, then you know it's a fraud. It's not now.
Yeah, so there's a couple places that I would think about. One of them is the Federal Trade Commission. They do trackings of consumer reports, or not consumer reports, but consumer complaints. This would be the first place I would start. There's another online service for complaining, and I think it's ICC, Internet Computer Crimes, that can also take in complaints, and it's usually monitored by multiple agencies to see whether or not there's a pattern or a trend. But you know, unfortunately, these are a dime a dozen, these calls, and the only way I've been able to combat it was going on the do not call list so that they would stop calling, but they find a way to get back on. So,
and the information on the phone calls for FTC and the ICC are in that Seniors on the Law newspaper in the back.
Helen, Who replaced you at the DA's office? Do you have a name, a contact there? And also that first phone number that you mentioned at the beginning, could you read that again, please?
Okay, the first phone number on Adult Protective Service,
yes,
was 415-557-5230. That's San Francisco's Elder Abuse Hotline. The second one, it was 800-677-1116 if you're not calling in the San Francisco area. And I'm sorry, what was your first question?
I'd like to know who's doing your role at the DA's office now.
I don't think anybody is.
Yeah, she was. You were on contract with the DA's office at that time, so I don't think we've quite found, I don't think we ever will find a replacement quite like Helen Carr.
How come you can remember something that you did 5 or 10 years ago, but you can't remember what you did yesterday?
Well, actually, if we have another hour, I can go into all of that. Basically, it's the hippocampus that helps with our short-term memory, and we have, in a different part of the brain, memories from farther back in time. So it's easier to remember what happened 10 years ago, or what I sometimes see is a woman who's got moderate dementia decides that, you know, that old gray-haired man who comes to visit her can't be her husband. It must be that younger man that looks like, you know, he did when they got married, and that's actually her son. So it's where the damage in the brain is occurring, and it, you know, the sad news is we peak in our brain abilities by the age of about 26, and then we slowly decline after that. One thing that we can all do is exercise, and it sounds like they're going to have a great program discussing that. Exercise and then baby aspirin for most folks, but again, talk to your doctor, are ways that you can cut down the risk of strokes and also decrease the rate of dementia for most folks.
Hi again. Doctor, you spoke at length about dementia. I had a question when you touched on delirium. How often have you seen elder abuse cases dealing with delirium, particularly in a medical crisis?
Well, the issue of the delirium, usually I haven't seen it that folks have everything stolen from them at the time of the hospitalization, but that's usually the time when the person who's abusing is going to get the two letters to get on the trust. And then when they get discharged, they get better. They're like, hey, I don't want to stay in this nursing home, or I don't want to be in assisted living. I want to go home. And they're like, but I got two letters. You've got dementia. You're staying here, you know, and I got your stuff. So that's where I've seen it be a problem.
Yeah, I'm running the case right now where during the delirium, the person signed the powers of attorney. After the fact got better, but in the time he was ill, this was
right. Basically, we can talk about that afterwards, but if someone is delirious and it's documented in the hospital chart, by definition, you don't have capacity. But then again, you know, I can't say how court cases always fall out.
I have two questions. The first one is I've recently had someone confide in me that they've been taken advantage of many times. And so learning about this list is very interesting. And also, I'm wondering, what can we do to reduce the stigma, to make people feel more comfortable talking about this and admitting when they've been taken advantage of? And the second question kind of tails into that. You mentioned the FTC when these calls come. But is that the same place, or is there someplace different once somebody has actually been scammed to report the scam itself and the money that's been taken?
You want to take the first question?
Well, let's see. I mean, for elders that I've worked with de facto, tracking down all the sources of scams, because they can mutate so quickly, doesn't work. Often you can get a phone where you can see the number of the person calling in and only answer the folks that you know. And the other thing that I've seen is have the caregivers answer. And the question of the stigma is that I kind of make it more like it's not unusual you know, they're very tricky. To tell you the truth, I tell the story that I was in Newport Beach to do a presentation, and I was thinking about my teenage sons and what I was doing, you know, with a couple other patients, and I got this call that Google Ads was going to have for one business in each area a special for $79.99 a month. And I was like, well, cool, that sounds good, so tell me about it. And then I'm like, hey, wait a minute. So it's not that they only look for the frail elders, and I tell them, you know, I've been scammed too, and they are very persuasive. And then I build a network around my elders to protect them.
Well, I guess just continue raising awareness in every way we can. Talk to your neighbors, your friends, your family, your children. Talk to your local police. Talk to Adult Protective Service, your doctors, anyone. Just keep raising awareness. Write letters to the newspaper. Talk to your elected officials. Maybe get, if there's some law that you think we lack in, which I kind of heard a little tonight, you know, talk to your assembly member or state senator. So just keep raising awareness about it. Thank you.
I think also support groups for elders are really important. We have one in San Mateo that meets monthly. So that's another place to get connections.
I also wanted to address the question you had with regard to once you've already been scammed, then it's a much more difficult scenario to actually try to get your money back, especially if it's one of the things that I will say, this is just as a tip of advice, is whenever the word Western Union comes in, that should be the automatic red flag. It's the most common vehicle that they're going to use to get money transferred over, and it's because Western Union's got a different set of being able to be tracked where the money goes. But typically, that'll be the key phrase. We need to send money. Can you Western Union it over? So if you see that, tell them to not send anything over yet. But in terms of actually being victimized, is then you got to go and report it to law enforcement. Okay, you know, just as a side note, we have our office actually plans prosecutors in all the district police stations. In fact, Marissa Rodriguez back there is one of our neighborhood prosecutors. I forgot which district she's in, but you can approach her on how to actually contact. If you run into a situation where law enforcement says, go get a civil attorney, but you think, I don't think this is civil, I think I've been victimized, you may want to touch base with a prosecutor. And they can actually kind of look at the case a little bit more closely. But you do want to get in contact with law enforcement because you may not be the only victim and you may be part of a bigger pattern that they've already been looking at. Let me give you an example of that. George Gascon spoke here a few months ago about the Chinese blessing scam. I don't know if many of you are familiar with these, but these were outside nationals that were coming specifically into this country to target elderly female Cantonese-speaking women and using cultural, emotional ploys to scare them into turning all their money over. And when that first happened, I remember being on a phone call with like six different cities, law enforcement detectives from six different cities, and we had no idea how to deal with it. It was the most unique scam, unbeknownst to us. Hong Kong had been dealing with this in the last 15, 20 years, and they've learned how to deal with it. So it took one of our investigators to actually communicate with them to figure out how they dealt with it. And it was really an issue of awareness to educate this particular targeted elder community, and it was also a coordination of multiple resources of law enforcement. So you may have one victim who may come home one day and say, someone told me that if I didn't give money over that there was going to be a curse placed on our family. That was one of many that were occurring at that time. And they were able to piece this together. And I'll say that this happened, another group came in about a year ago. And when it came in, all these law enforcement agencies reactivated all their networks. And we were able to communicate with Department of Homeland Security and literally lock the borders because we had their pictures. And before they boarded their plane, they spent some time in the local jails before each of the counties can get them. But that was only because it was reported. I suspect there were many that were unreported because many of the victims did not want to come forward with this. We had some issues with the ones that actually did report it. But you want to report it. And if someone says to you it's a civil nature, you want to maybe escalate it because it really could be something of a much bigger pattern that someone actually is monitoring.
We have time for one more question.
Greetings. My name is Martine Barbier. I'm a victim advocate with the District Attorney's Office. So I know to address the question with regards to who do we call or what do you do, you know, our office is located at 850 Bryant Street, so we're at room 320, and you'll be greeted with an advocate like myself. I'm part of the Elder Abuse Program, or as I like to call it, Elder Justice Program. You can certainly call us at 415-553-9044. And we can address questions with regards to elder scams. We've certainly worked directly with the community. You know, we also have a consumer fraud division, and they can also direct you to where you can report some of these scams, identity thefts and such. And that number is 415-551-9595. We work closely with APS, as Helen was stating. And again, their number directly, their local office is 415-355-6700. So we're in tandem with APS. We are collaborative with them in regards to their forensic center meetings. We work as a multidisciplinary team, and we really want to address justice with regards to elders. So please feel free to call me or our office, and we have brochures here, and we can also discuss further if this is an issue affecting you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. There are brochures down by the door, so I invite you to please pick one up. Lots of good information there. I'd like to ask our distinguished panel if you would be willing to answer some individual questions as we close the program.
Sure.
Be all right? Wonderful. Well, our thanks to Helen Carr and our distinguished panelists for our program today. We also thank our audience here as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 112th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned. Thank you.